Hey, everybody, welcome to another Horse Geeks podcast where we look at horses and riders and a bit of life from the inside out. I'm Kirsten Nelson, professional horse trainer and developer of the training program Training for Optimal Balance. And with me is Deb Romero, certified Alexander Technique instructor and developer of Optimal Posture. So today we wanted to continue the conversation a little bit from last time, but focus in on some of the differences between the human spine and spinal functions versus the horse's spine and functions of a quadruped, basically, versus functions as a biped. Knowing that standing upright gave us bigger brains. I loved that in the last podcast. I was like, I thought about that all week.
Going, did you?
I did, because it just never occurred to me to think about it like that. Like, oh, our uprightness actually furthered our brain's development. Like,
yeah,
that
just,
it really stuck with me.
Yeah, it had to, because the use of our limbs completely changed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that was the main reason. Fascinating.
So this week, I may have you lead off the conversation as much more of an expert on human spines than I am. Like, from my perception, the main difference between human spines and horses' spines or any quadruped is that our spines, just like Slipshire's goat, have four natural curves. And I would think a larger natural range of motion than a quadruped spine. So a horse's spine is naturally meant to be rigid. So the articulation in the joints is actually really minimal. And I'll talk about Leo Jeffcott's paper a little bit. He wrote it in 1980, titled Natural Rigidity of the Horse's Backbone. And I think that's something that's really important for riders to understand, is that the horse's spine is just not meant to be as mobile as the human spine.
So when you say mobile, because I think of it in like 3D or something, because, you know, there's all this language in the horse world, lateral bending, la, 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 all of that. So can you speak a little bit about, you know, front, back, left, right, maybe?
Well, right out of Jeffcott's paper, what they did was they did necropsies on, I don't know, 6 to 12 horses. I think they were all thoroughbred race horses. And so what they did is they take out basically the axial skeleton, they remove the rib cage, and they look at sort of just the motor functions, like what's the range of motion in the vertebra, right? So the back.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So the backbone is the thoraco and lumbar spine. So the back of the horse is the thoracic lumbar vertebra. The neck is obviously the cervical. And in the pelvis, that's where the sacrum and the coccyx part of the spine are, just like us. So it's
just
not
like us.
Dissimilar, but they're on a horizontal plane with four limbs on the ground, and we're on a vertical plane with only two limbs on the ground. So what was fascinating about that is that the full range of motion in the vertebra of the horse between what they call dorsiflexion and ventroflexion. So dorsal is the top and ventral is the bottom on a horse. So basically, they're taking the vertebra of the thoracolumbar spine through what is a range of motion in the bones between maximum, what we would call longitudinal flexion, and maximum longitudinal extension. So up and down, the full range of motion for the bones was 53.1 millimeters.
Wow, millimeters.
Millimeters. And it doesn't look like that. It looks like the horse's back goes up and down about a foot, but all of that is muscular, right?
Right.
It's
so muscular. That isn't spinal, right?
It's not necessarily in the spine. And then the other part was, he said virtually, which means less than a easy to measure amount, so under a millimeter, virtually no lateral or rotatory movement of the spine.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's just, all that lateral bending stuff?
I know. I know. It's got to be actually in the vertebra, really in the spine itself, which is going to affect the central nervous system, right? So the pattern of movement dictated by the central nervous system is housed in the spine. So why would the spine have a huge range of motion?
Exactly.
It would compromise the function of the entire body. So when we're kind of cranking our horses' necks around, it's like, I think what we see when a horse is in full extension, or what would be called ventroflexion, the head goes way up, the back goes way down, the pelvis shifts backwards. So it's not the actual spine that's moving that much. It's the whole body taking a different shape. Every bone in the skeleton is reorganizing around a minute amount of change in the spine.
And that's pretty comparable to the human spine. The actual vertebrae don't have much movement, like you said. It's the ligaments and the muscles and all of that that have the movement.
And see, that's where I was anxious to talk to you about this, because my perception of my own spine is that I have like, inches of lateral flexion, right? Or extension and flexion front to back. And so it's like that perception is, I think, why we think folding a horse in half is going to make them supple.
So you say know? That again, folding them in half.
Folding them in half. You know, what I mean is like really cranking the neck out of line with the thoracic lumbar spine. So really bending the neck, or really getting them to move off the leg where the ribs sort of shift left or right. We think of all of that as a healthy range of motion for the spine, which would supple the muscles. And if you really think of the spine, especially in a horse having such a limited range of motion, as soon as the spine becomes pushed out of a healthy range of motion, which we're talking millimeters, then the muscles, I think, would necessarily contract, or the spine would snap.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, the muscles create immobility of the spine.
Right. And in this great book I was talking to you about by Mabel Todd, The Thinking Body, she wrote this in the 30s. She was a doctor. She said, she was talking about the difference between a quadruped and a biped. And the language she used was, with the quadruped, the situation is a rack, the spine, with things hanging off of it.
Yes.
And I really liked that.
That's a great description, because humans are more pelvic.
Exactly.
So it's our pelvis that gives us a lot of stability during motion. But in a horse, it's actually the thoracolumbar spine that acts like our human pelvis acts for us as a biped.
Right. And I did some research on it, and we're not born with all these curves. The two primary curves are the thoracic and the pelvic, but the other two, the cervical and the lumbar, come in developmental stages.
Really?
Yeah. I thought that was fascinating, because a baby is pretty much born with a straight spine.
You look at little babies when they first sit upright, they're like stick straight with this giant head balancing on top.
But yeah. It is that part of the stages of wanting to balance the head on top of the neck that creates the curve.
Oh, and that interesting.
That also creates the lumbar curve, because you've got those opposing curves. And the reasons we have those curves being a biped is for movement.
And so explain how the curves, how is that related to movement?
Well, if you think about your spine being straight, how movable is that if it was like a stick? Or you take the horse and put him upright.
Yes.
That biomechanically just doesn't work.
So as a quadruped, it does work because
Right.
it's like everything hangs off of this horizontal
Right.
stick. But as a biped, just like Slipshear's goat, those curves actually allow us to balance and rebalance during motion. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and it helps with the shear of managing the forces, the curves. Because if you think of it, the quadrupeds have four things they're balancing on, where the biped only has two things they're balancing on.
Right.
So that hanging of the quadruped also gives more mobility in the joints of the legs of the horse, as opposed to less mobility
Yes.
for the human, which I found fascinating comparison.
Yeah, because the horse's pelvis, you can, on a practical level, this is really simplifying it, but it acts more like a leg bone than it does the way the
Oh, that's
human pelvis works.
exactly.
So it rotates a bit with the hip joint. So there's cranial caudal movement of the pelvis, and it just, if you sort of draw a line through the angle of the pelvis to the femur to the and then the stifle down to the hock to the hoof, it's like this zigzag that opens and closes. So that's how their pelvis sort of acts more like a leg bone with a joint than it does a stabilizing part of the body. So then the thoracolumbar spine becomes this stick that sort of the front limbs and the shoulders hang off of, and the pelvis and the hind leg apparatus hangs off of.
Yeah, so that to me is, a big difference because we have that the curves for more movement, more mobility, where the horse is the opposite.
But you're saying too that the actual movement, the vertebral movement between vertebra, is just as small.
Right. The main difference is because of the discs and the cartilage that can create, because we are vertical, that can create more shear in between the discs.
Is that like a concussive force, shear, or can you define shear?
Shear is movement in a non-correct biomechanical sense. So if we reach way too far, that's more shear, where it would be like comparing that lateral bending we all think for our horse.
Is creating shear in the horse's vertebra column.
Right, because as you said, the facets in the human, which are the joints in the back, are there's facets in horses, and there's just not a lot of movement there.
No, very little movement. And,
Yeah.
for Jephcott to say virtually no lateral or rotatory movement of the spine, that means it's almost too hard to measure. I'm sure that there is lateral movement and rotation of the spine, as well as, flexion and extension up and down. But it's the more we minimalize it, the rest of the body can function more fluidly around it. So,
Okay, so
like we've
you're
talked about
saying the
before, that stability of the axial skeleton, whether it's human or
yes.
horse, is what allows the appendicular skeleton to move in a greater range of motion.
Exactly.
And I think that's what this is the same between horses and humans. But when we think of horses' spines similar to human spines, we can laterally bend and rotate or twist or sort of push forward and back with our spines comfortably in what feels like this greater range of motion in our spinal bones.
Yes.
Right. And when we do that with horses, what happens is, I think the actual range of motion is even smaller than a human. It's also the backbone is meant to be the stable, organizing sort of home base for the whole body. So when we're on the horse and people say move with the horse and we actually shift our body around, you think, how much muscular tension is that creating? Because the spine is, if we're adding force of motion against the back muscles affecting the spine, as soon as we push even a tiny bit, the body will have to protect the spine and limit the range of motion from that force by tightening the muscles.
Right.
You following me on that?
Well, I'm thinking of tightening the muscles in the horse. And then I think, well, what's happening if the rider's tightening? Or like you said, following the horse's movement, which may not be correct in the first place, and how that's just dysfunction upon dysfunction.
And it's really any instability in the rider, because we straddle their thoracic spine and the back of the saddle ends at the beginning of the lumbar spine. Hopefully, sometimes it extends over the lumbar spine. So where we sit in the saddle directly affects the thoracolumbar spine. So an unstable rider is going to generate forces that are going to act on the horse's spine, destabilizing the bones of the spine. So the only thing the body can do is tense the muscles of the back to prevent unsafe, excessive movement of the spine, right? So a rider who's unstable can be too loose on purpose, thinking looser is better because they're somehow, it feels softer to them, so they feel it's better for the horse. Or riders that are too stiff are going to be like little bouncing balls on the back of the horse. So if we get too stiff as a rider, we become unstable. And if we get too loose as a rider, we become unstable. But any instability in the rider is going to generate forces that act directly on the horse's thoracolumbar spine, generating forces that are pushing the spine too much.
And we as humans, and us, me being an Alexander teacher, we bring our own lack of mechanical balance to the horse. Unless we're working with a practitioner, an Alexander teacher or something to help us. So that just, to me, just magnifies situations. I was on a equine senior riders thing on Facebook, and it was amazing to me the people that were complaining about how much the pain they're in when they ride.
Really?
Yes. I thought, wow. That was
I find pain relief when I ride. If I'm not riding enough, I stiffen up a bit. I have worse habits off the horse than I have on the horse.
Yeah, I think I pay more attention to my biomechanical use when I'm riding than in everyday life. But yeah. And another thing I found, the comparison was that the human spine, the actual bodies of the vertebrae, are much closer to the middle of the body than people think.
Mm.
And to me, when I visualize a horse, they're kind of on top, except for the cervicals of the horse when they come into the thoracic. That's really deep right there.
The spine is actually pretty deep. Like if you run your hand, what we're feeling on the top that we call the backbone of the horse, especially at the withers, are the spinous processes. So horses have very long spinous processes, which are part of each vertebra.
Right.
Right. So the actual vertebra just has this long tip to it, long dorsal tip. So we can feel the backbones with our fingertips. But if you run your hand from the top of the back where you feel the tips of the spinous processes down to the top of the rib cage, it's a good, the spine is actually inside the rib cage. So it's a good 6-8 inches from the top of the back to the top of the rib cage.
That's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah. Yeah. So it's much deeper than especially what we visually see. And the same thing with people. When I start saying, you know, that it's your spine begins behind your ears and behind your nose, that sometimes just blows people's minds. They're like, what? It's there?
Yeah.
So it's much more central, like as riders, hunter-jumper riders, we've been taught, you know, ears, shoulders, hips, and everything right in alignment. So that's kind of where the human spine is, the bodies, the working part. Like you said, we can feel those dorsal tips on our back too, but the working bodies with the discs and everything are much more centrally located.
Yes. Like it actually sort of surprised me kind of looking at the human skeleton and where our seat bones are or the ischium of our pelvis. It's like our seat bones somehow feel more centrally located in the middle of our body. But, and if you look at a skeleton, the coccyx, the sacrum is right there.
It is. Yes.
It's not far away.
Not
so
at all.
We tend to think of our spine at our back and our seat bones at our middle, but the seat bones are directly under the spine.
They should be, unless you're sitting on your pockets, which most people do. And I'm wondering if they knew that relationship between where the spine is actually located, where your seat bones are, if it would change a rider's perspective on where to sit, how to use their body on top of the horse.
Right.
That doesn't get in the way.
Well, and I think also people I don't know, you can tell me about humans, but epaxial back muscle or epaxial muscles of the spine just mean all the muscles that are located dorsally or above the spine on the horse.
Okay.
There's 6 major epaxial back muscles and they are massive. So, you know, when we get steaks from a cow, those are the back muscles. For a large part, those are the back muscles and they're massive. And so those massive muscles, you think, what's the point? Horses weren't born intended for riders, right? So I don't know about humans, but like on all quadrupeds, the biggest, thickest, strongest muscles in the body are around the thoracolumbar spine and the lower spine, the pelvis and sacrum coccyx, right? So the hindquarter muscles are a little more for locomotion, but as well as stability. But the back muscles are almost entirely to support stability of the spine.
Right. I think the only big difference in a very basic way, I know the names of the muscles are usually always the same, whether it's a quadruped or biped, but the extensor muscles, which go from the base of the skull, which I think they do in a horse too, all the way down the back. And you can get this visual of a baby running, right? What do they do when they run? They look like they're going to fall on their face.
Yes.
Well, that's what the extensor muscles are supposed to do. Keep you from falling.
Ah.
Not to hold you up.
Resisting gravity.
Resisting the face fall.
Yeah.
And we, as we age, kind of lose that concept. And that's part of our, you know, the shearing that goes on or the disc problems. So, and I really liked what you said about what happens down at the pelvis. So with the human spine, the transfer of weight goes from the head to the thorax to the pelvis. to the iliums, to the heads of the femurs, which is your thigh bone.
Mm.
So it kind of sounds, you know, that's also a major area of stability for the human.
Yes.
Is, you could call it the pelvic girdle if you want, but that relationship, and you can even draw lines at those points that the transfer of weight is from the occiput to C1, the 12th thoracic to L1, L5 to the sacrum, sacrum to ilium, to the head of the femur. So that's how the transfer of weight goes in a human.
It's not our feet, you mean?
Well, it eventually gets there. It eventually gets there.
Yeah.
But
no, but really we sustain our body weight primarily exactly as you're describing.
Yeah. Yeah. So the horse, I guess, would probably be different.
Well, what a horse does as a quadruped is as the hind legs create a forward pushing force when they move backwards, right? So that force translates from the legs through the sacrum, SI joint, into the spine, travels through the back muscles and the spine. And if it's not controlled by the function of the spine and the back muscles, then their body weight succumbs to gravity. So they push themselves forward and overbearing weight on the front limbs if they don't coordinate the back muscles and stabilize that thoracolumbar spine. So what we call a horse on the forehand is a horse that isn't resisting gravity. So every step that they push themselves forward, if they're not probably the same as you're describing, those extensor muscles sort of resisting the fall forward, then they literally push their own body weight onto their front limbs. And that's where you get too much concussion on the front limbs, leading to a ton of different lameness issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those big muscles of the back in the horse have sort of a dual purpose of, just like you're describing, like a little toddler running, the muscles that make them not fall on their face are the muscles that control the body weight in forward motion. So the hindquarter and the back of the horse have two jobs: propel the body forward and resist forward forces to stabilize the forward motion. So there's a management of force and a resistance of force happening at the same time.
Wow. Okay. Management of force and resisting the falling, almost like a person.
Yeah.
The falling on your face is the horse falling on the forehand.
Yes. It's exactly the same.
Cool.
And what do we do when we fall? We fall on our forehand too. Everybody sticks their arms straight out. If they know they're going to fall, they're going to save the face.
Save the face. So, and what about, I'm real curious about the relationship of the head neck in the quadruped as opposed to ours. Because ours is the occiput and C1 is like a rocker joint. So it allows us to do all this distortion of our head, unfortunately.
What we call their pole,
right,
is sort of you have the skull and then the atlas, which is C1, which is responsible on the horse for the same as a human. It's the nodding yes and no joint. But then they have on C2, there's a little bony proliferation, I guess, called the dens that fits into C1. And C2 is responsible for sort of tilting the head left and right, rotating.
And that would be our no joint.
No, not exactly. It would be more like if you lift one ear.
Oh, so it's a oblique lateral type movement.
Rotation rather than.
Oh, so ours is yes, which is the top joint. And then the second joint is no on a human.
Yeah. So on a horse, the first joint is yes. And the second joint is, what'd you say? What'd you say? And only by the third cervical vertebra can lateral bending occur.
Interesting.
Which would be the no.
Would be the no. Okay.
Yeah, it would be the shaking the head no.
Shaking the head no. Wow. Mm-hmm.
So that's why we call it the pole, because horses don't have like our, what is it? I forget what you call it. The very first joint. I know it's called I can't think of the name, a completely rotational joint. Mm-hmm. So like, as we talk about different types of joints, it's like a free joint.
Right. It's not like a hinge joint or anything like that.
And I forget the specific name of that, but it's like it has a 360 degree full range of motion, mm-hmm. that first joint. On the horse, not so much. It's more like a hinge, and then the dens and sort of the rotation,
side to side,
and then sort of bending. So their head movement is dependent on the upper cervical spine, not just the one joint.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So when we're asking a horse,
I think it's called the axio-occipital joint, AO. Does that mm-hmm, ring a bell? Mm-hmm. AO. So the AO joint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not quite like a human's. It's much more restricted.
Right. And I would think, because we have the support of the cervical vertebrae, because our skeleton, axial skeleton, is more like stacking.
Yes.
Where the horse, the relationship being a quadruped, of gravity affecting, you know.
So like on a horse's thoracolumbar spine, once you get to the thorax, the little slices of spine look like the humans.
The bodies of the vertebrae, if you're doing an MRI.
Yeah. So the vertebral bodies, they just have these long dorsal bones, but mm-hmm. the vertebral bodies sort of stack like a human's. But a horse in the cervical spine is very different.
Yes.
Is very different. So the bones of a horse's neck actually are more elongated and how could I describe them? They fit into one another differently. So it's more like a daisy chain than it is the little slices like our
neck.
That's
a good way to put it. It is. And they remind me more of being more in the horse rectangular.
Yeah, they're more rectangular.
They're long. Yeah, they're long.
I was going to say oval or rectangular shaped.
Yeah.
And they sort of, one fits into the other.
Yes.
So when a horse, basically, if a horse rotates and tilts the head, it goes all the way down to C7. So they still have seven cervical vertebrae like we do, but the function of them are different and the structure is very different.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Say that again. So if you've got a rotation or a lateral movement with the head, say up at C2, it goes down the entire neck. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, which is probably similar to humans. So because rotation is a twisting function. Mm-hmm. So if I twist my head, I can feel it in my thoracic spine.
Right. It's all interconnected. Yeah.
Right. But because our vertebra in our neck stack with discs similar to our thoracic vertebra, it's a little different in that. How do I say that? It's not as much of a chain reaction. It's more like a spiraling effect through the human body, where in a horse, it's like twisting a chain.
Yeah, I think I was working with somebody on this, and it's for humans, what it should be, if it's close to being biomechanically correct, you're just kind of turning on your axis, you know, your whole
That's exactly how it should be for the horse. But if you think about it, horses evolved, they're quadrupeds and they're prey animals. So that long neck and heavy head serve several functions. And the head is heavy. It's usually about 1/10 of their body weight because it's so much bone, right? So a 1,000-pound horse has a 100-pound head.
Human heads are between 10 and 15 or 16 pounds. So
that's a significant percentage as well. So horses, like with that long neck, it allowed them to forage for food high and low. It also gave them greater than 360-degree perception for predators. Right. So they can elevate the head, bend the neck, do all kinds of things with their head and neck in order to find food, forage food, and detect predators. It's an unsupported huge limb on a horse.
Oh, I like the way you said that. Unsupported huge limb.
Yeah. That's so the visual. Way they use their head and neck related to balance is if that thoracolumbar spine that we're talking about should be like a stick that everything organizes, moves around, organizes off of and moves around. When that stick becomes wiggly or compromised, they use their head and neck as a counterbalance to any loss of balance in the back. So in other words, as humans, if we lose our balance because our front limbs are no longer on the ground, we sort of stick them out and like wave our arms up and down to stabilize our balance if we lose our balance, right?
Right.
But the horse's arms are on the ground. So as their axial skeleton or they gain and lose balance in their body, the head and neck going up and down is the way we use our arms.
It's kind of like the seesaw.
The balance. Mm-hmm. So if you think of a tightrope walker, you know how they use their arms to the side, balance. A horse on a tightrope would have to move its neck all over the place to do the same thing.
Wow.
So that's why restricting a horse's neck, trying to build balance or a frame or lift the back by using leverage on the neck is the most mobile part of their entire spine. So it's easy to contort it. It's easy to use leverage on it because it's highly mobile and it's not super strong muscularly. So for them to be restricted in their head and neck with reins or a bit or tie downs or martingales, that would be the equivalent to strapping somebody's arms to their side while they're moving.
We could play with that.
Yeah. Like and that running away up, with your arms tied behind your back.
But that brings up a lot of stuff in me. Fear, anxiety, you know, thinking of and losing my balance and not being able to regain it by the use of my limbs.
Right.
That's interesting.
And that's why a lot of horses become heavy to the bit, where we go for more leverage or they run through the bridle or all these problems we have with horses not responding to our rein contact or leaning on the bit where they weigh a million pounds. What they've learned to do is go, well, if I can't find my own balance, I can sort of tripod myself on my front legs and my mouth, and the rider will hold me up.
Wow.
And that's why horses feel heavy in the reins, is because once the body weight goes forward, if you don't have bit resistance, they're going to fall into long and low. So the head and neck will shift down below the back. If you have bit resistance, then they can do a bunch of different things. They can be heavy. They can sort of overflex the neck and get the pressure off of their mouth by contracting the muscles of the neck and sort of distorting the use of the vertebra. And you'll see it in a dropped pole or the face behind the vertical. Or they'll put the their chin into their chest. And all of those are ways to escape pressure in the mouth, but they haven't been able to shift the weight off the front legs or control the body weight. I should say more accurately, they haven't been able to control their own body weight from falling to the front legs.
I think that that's key to me, controlling their own body weight.
That's the whole reason we want a lifted back. I don't think people realize that. I think, you know, we think of the horse lifting the back, which is dorsiflexion of the spine, which, by the way, 53.1 millimeters, you know.
I don't even know if I could see that.
I know, right? But we feel it because those millimeters are critical as the use of controlling their own body weight and stabilizing their back during motion. So lifting the back is not just because we want more agility or performance, or we want to please the judge. It's literally how they prevent falling forward.
Wow. And can you speak about, like, what do you mean by lifting the back and not being in extension? Well, that would be the opposite, right?
On the vertical plane, the back on a horse can only go up and down. So on us, okay. On humans, it's called anterior posterior, mm-hmm. right? So it's front and back. But because a horse is a quadruped, it's dorsal and ventral. That's right. The up and down of the back. So dorsiflexion is the spine at that sort of maximum movement between the joints, coming into what we call longitudinal flexion of the spine. So right. The vertebra at the bottom of the spine or the ventral side, the bones are coming closer together. That's all. Flexion just means the bones in a joint are coming closer together. And extension just means the bones of any joint, it's generic, are moving farther apart. So when we talk about the joints between each vertebra, longitudinal extension means at the bottom of the spine or on the underside of the horse, the spine bones are moving farther apart, which means the bones on the dorsal side or the top side have to be moving closer together. So when that becomes a habit, they can develop a condition that we call kissing spine in a horse, yeah. which can be the dorsal tips of the spine coming way too close and actually creating a bone-on-bone pain issue. And I think in humans, I don't know that we have kissing spine. I think we blow discs.
Exactly, because we are vertical and we're more of a stacking system. It's the intervertebral discs that
shear. They give way.
It's a shearing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can. If we, so the ventral is our anterior and the posterior. If, you know, we have a habit, say in a posture of sitting that we're slouching, then that, you know, the anterior part of that disc is getting squished and
yeah.
It can tear.
It has even like lifting our chin up too high, and it's going to basically create extension yes. on the front side of our neck anteriorly, and it's going to create too much flexion on the posterior side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how we compress discs. So with horses, it can become a bone on bone issue. Before, I don't think they even blow discs. I would have to research that.
I'd have to look at discs.
Yeah.
I've never heard
ever
of that mentioned, even when my horse, Callie, when we found out that her quote unquote lameness, intermittent lameness, was actually deterioration and stenosis and bone spurs in her neck.
Yes.
but I didn't ever hear the vet mention anything about a disc.
I'm going to have to research that.
Yeah, do
I don't know.
That'd be fun.
I mean, from looking at x-rays and just working with horses all these years, there's no such thing as a blown disc in a horse, as far as
we
know
of.
I don't even know that they have discs. It might just be a cartilage to cartilage.
Yeah.
Like the human spine has those little bloody pockets of soft disc material, but I don't know that horses even have that. I'm pretty sure they do not in the neck, but I'd have to actually research about the back.
The back. Yeah. That would be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to talk about that sometime.
Yeah. And I liked it when you were talking about, cause we're always looking for this pole flexion. But I hardly ever see a true pole flexion.
Well, what we're sort of told is elevate the pole, which is the pole is basically the joints between the skull, C1, C1 to C2, C2 to C3. That's what we call the pole. And so elevating the pole is what happens when they go into maximum dorsiflexion of the thoracolumbar spine, because the whole spine has upward force, which is the muscles of the back pulling the spine up, right? Through how they manage the forces of forward motion and their body weight. So when the back lifts, the whole cervical spine sort of translates upward and slightly backward. And that's what elevates the pole. And the skull moves forward and away.
I like that because I can compare that when you were just showing that this kind of the movement of the neck of a human, if you don't move it at the occiput C1, it's the same problem as I see in horses. If we're moving it, if we're thinking of the pole elevated at C4.
Mm.
But the pole is actually dropped. You know what I
mean?
Yes.
Yes.
And so that's the same for humans.
Yes. And the pole can be dropped because the horse is just escaping pressure in the mouth, but hasn't actually flexed the spine. Hasn't actually upwardly dorsiflexed the thoracolumbar spine. Right. Yeah. So, and if we try to build a frame by creating all this resistance in their mouth, we can really damage the function of the neck. And it does not create dorsiflexion of the thoracolumbar spine. That's created much farther back in how they control the forces of forward motion and manage their body weight in forward motion, which is all done through the epaxial back muscles and the thoracolumbar spine as that central point of organization. So the use of the head and neck is actually a reflection of the use of the thoracolumbar spine. So when they're unstable or not managing forces well through the back, the head and neck need to adjust, just like we would balance with our arms on that tightrope.
Right.
And so when we restrict that with gadgets or rein pressure or bit leverage, it doesn't make them lift their back. They just contort the neck.
Right? So it's kind of a visual that I think a lot of us have gotten in our head that's part of it.
Yeah, we think of building a frame from the head to the
backwards.
Back.
Yeah.
And the way it really works is when we stabilize the hindquarters and balance that ability for them to push forward and stabilize their body weight within the forward motion or resist gravity, then the head and neck free and take the right position. But on the way there, they kind of need some freedom with their head and neck because they're constantly adjusting their balance through the back and all four limbs.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And it's just a different way of thinking about it.
Yes, I agree. That's a good comparison because the human pole can be just as distorted as what you were just talking about with horses. So,
yeah, because if we had to walk across a balance beam and our instructor said, okay, the first thing we're going to do is tie a rope around your arms so you can't move your arms, we would be contorting our head. Right. And again, it's a little bit of a sink or swim situation. Some horses, just like some people, might be talented enough to figure out how to do that.
Exactly.
And a lot of the other horses will, or people would probably lose their balance. And it wouldn't be so easy to find balance if you've restricted the balancing sort of mechanism.
Right. That's really important. Restricting the balancing components. Yeah.
I also wanted to bring up a quote from the paper I did pull up by Leo Jeffcott, 1980, Natural Rigidity of the Horse's Backbone. In his summary, one of the things, which is why we're even talking about this, is also how we perceive motion in general, how the body organizes it. So in his summary, he writes, the biomechanics of the vertebral column, although very complex, are of vital importance because they form the basis of all body's movement. And that's a theory that you and I have basically have in common.
Yeah, we live by that.
And it's the theory behind the Alexander technique, as well as the theory behind how I work with horses, that the functions of the spine and the stability of the spine dictate how every muscle is used, which muscles atrophy, which muscles overwork, how much tension or tone or whatever they have, the tensile use of tendons and ligaments, the concussive forces on bones and joints, all of that is dictated by the central nervous system, which is directly related to the functions of the spine.
Exactly. Yeah. We're both on the same page with that. It's just, as we've always said, it's, you know, you're riding a spine on a spine when you're on a horse.
And yet I see all the time people playing with the neck, trying to get the legs, not really understanding the functions of the back. So in the horse world, you'll see people tapping legs with whips, trying to teach them a new movement. You see all of this like unending restriction of the head and neck of the horse, trying to get the back. And it's like, no, once you understand that the spinal functions, which are the skull, the neck, the back, and the pelvis, I go, those are the key ingredients if we really want the horse to function correctly. And it works back to front.
Same for the human. Same for the human. I think that's, you know, why we even started these podcasts.
Yeah. Just to look at things from a different perspective.
Yeah,
and just literally
to look at that, totally different. Yeah, I like that. Cool.
So anything you want to add?
I think I covered just about everything. The
and
curves
I have
in the spine are for movement. That's all.
I have one last question for you, in that some of the largest muscles in the horse are in the back and through the upper part of the hindquarter. Mm-hmm. Would you say that's similar to humans, or is it different? Like, are our leg muscles more important or bigger?
So I'm very curious about the word largest.
That's a good question. What I mean by largest is not necessarily, I would have to take in the mass, not necessarily the strength, but the mass, which would be length and density and weight and all of that. So the mass of the muscle.
So of course my mind is immediately drawn to the psoas muscle because of its mass. And, you know, it's a main connecting muscle between the pelvis and the legs. So, you know, that's, I would say it's.
Same is true on a horse and quadrupeds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you go down the vertebral column of the human, because we're upright, the actual size of the bony part of the bodies of the discs get bigger.
Ah, yes.
So, because of gravity and our uprightness, everything gets bigger the lower it gets until you get to,
So
the
our back,
lumbar.
would you say our back muscles are then less important because of the weight bearing you described earlier of how it goes down the spine, sort of into the pelvis and the upper legs?
I would say they're more interdependent upon the whole system to maintain the uprightness, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. And on a
Yeah.
horse, even though the vertebra change similar to a human,
Right.
the lumbar are bigger and have bigger wings to the side. I think their back muscles, because that thoracolumbar spine is very a central key part of their overall use and stability, that the back muscles are massive. They're
Yeah.
massive on a horse. And on necropsies, when you peel back the skin of a horse, it's just sheets of fascia and aponeurosis.
We
It's
also have a lot of sheets of fascia, especially there's a huge one in the lumbar area coming down the back. So we're to me, the pelvic area is like Grand Central Station.
And that's the difference then, because on a horse, we sort of, again, we think in human terms that we want them to sit on their hindquarters to lift
Ooh,
their
that's a good
back,
one.
right? And
That's a
in a
good one.
horse, it's not. Grand Central is the thoracolumbar spine that we straddle, that we
Right.
put the saddle on. That is command central of the whole body.
Yeah. So,
Or
yeah,
Grand Central, I think you said.
Grand Central Station.
Yeah.
It's where everybody meets. That's why I call it that. Yeah, cool.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining us for this discussion. We hope you got a lot out of it. And please like, share, subscribe. And if you enjoy our Horse Geeks podcast, please come back. And thanks for being here today. Thanks for hanging in to the end, especially if you're still here. And have a great day, everyone. We will see you later.
Be kind, everybody. Bye.
Bye.